I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Joining us on the line is Daniel Erspommer, CEO of the Pelican Institute Institute, and they have provided a report that outlines reforms and solutions for addressing public health emergencies in Louisiana at the special session that is being considered by the Louisiana legislature. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Hey, Newell, great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it. So let's get into what it is that you guys are proposing, if you would outline that for us.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we started a couple of months ago really diving in to better understand current law, current jurisprudence, what have the courts been saying about this, and to take a look at what is the right structure of government, what's the right structure of the chain of command here in a public health emergency. And we outlined a handful, four or five core recommendations. I'll highlight maybe three of them. One is that the legislature should require the governor to seek legislative approval to extend that state of emergency beyond the first 30 days. So current law would remain in effect for the first 30 days. That's the governor's call. And after that, it should be important for the governor to present his or her case to the legislature and bring legislative leaders in. The second one would be to just clarify. There was a lot of confusion, I think, about the ability for the governor to declare both a public health emergency and a disaster emergency, especially with a lot of debate around petitions and everything else. We just want to clarify, it's called the Louisiana Homeland Security and Emergency Assistance and Disaster Act. That's a mouthful. To just clarify that inconsistency and make sure the governor can do both. And then the last thing maybe worth highlighting at this point is as we go forward, hopefully we don't have to face this again, but if we do, that executive orders should consider, rather than essential or non-essential, of course, every job is essential to the person who has it, but rather look at things in the view of safe and unsafe. And that will be a better way to protect life and liberty in the course of a pandemic.
So when we think about the first issue, so after the first 30 days, he would have to seek legislative approval for a predetermined set of amount of time, or the legislature decides how much time they want to give him for the continuing declaration of the emergency?
Yeah, that's right. Look, the country, the American founding for sure, and as we look across government, part of the reason why the American experiment has thrived all these years is effective checks and balances, that no branch of government has an overly aggressive or overly powerful role, particularly when it comes to issues that have direct impact on life and work and liberty. And so this is really in response to seeing that there is no check beyond a completely nuclear option of just ending the whole thing. That the legislature has on the governor's power in this. And we've got to remember, legislators are the most responsive to their constituents or the closest to their constituents, and that's why they have a special rule in a separation of powers.
So the legislature would have to call themselves back in order to vote?
If they weren't already in session, that would be right.
Well, isn't that, I mean, that's like a huge problem operationally, is it not?
Well, there's other means to do it. I think that's up for debate. You could do it similar to the way they call themselves into special session, where majority of legislators would have to sign that call or sign on to the petition. There are a variety of ways, and I think we're relatively agnostic about how that happens, and there's a few approaches to it, as long as we get those checks and balances in the system.
Yeah, but the checks and balances require a debate on the subject, right? I mean, so any kind of roll call kind of situation where one's not allowed an opportunity to present a case, isn't that kind of deficient at its very core?
I would agree with you. I think the debate is the most important piece of this. You know, part of the challenge that we've seen in the current situation, whether you agree with the governor's decision or not, there's only been one instance so far where the governor and his team have had to answer questions in a public forum from the legislature and to provide the data, the backup data on which they're making decisions. That's important for the public to hear on such a consequential moment, on such a consequential time. Again, hopefully we don't have to face this again, but I think we have to prepare as though we will.
But hadn't that been the reluctance of the state legislature to call themselves into session in order to receive that information for the governor?
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, they've had every opportunity to call themselves into session and request the governor to make an appearance and present the evidence that they seek, right? He hasn't said no.
Well, I think we're seeing that right now. Yeah. And if you talk to some legislators, they will tell you they have asked for a lot of that information and been told no from time to time. So I think, you know, to suggest the data has been readily available to the public or to the legislature at large, we haven't seen that in this case. Most importantly, it's a principle of the matter that when you're talking about the ability to close down an economy, to shut down unilaterally certain businesses, to be able to do that, whether it's this governor or the next one or the one after that, it's irrelevant to the person. Check and balance on that is a deficient system in our point of view.
No, I agree with you. It's really not about this governor, and I agree
absolutely
with that. But I try to look at what's currently happening and changing this in midstream of what's going on right now. It just seems a little suspicious to me as to why they're addressing this. So is there an exception if the president declares a national emergency to these rules?
I think because we're dealing with issues that the governor makes the decision on, these are not decisions that the president decides, that wouldn't affect the rules of the game. The goal here is not...
But what if the president does declare a national emergency? As has been done in this case, and the fact of the matter is that that's continuing. Are we gonna compel governors to go to the legislature every 30 days if there's an overarching national emergency?
Well, again, it's not the president's order that decides whether businesses are closed or whether people are allowed to leave their homes or go about their daily lives. The president's order sets into motion funding mechanisms, of course. And frankly, that's part of the deficiency of the current system. Legislators who disagree with or who want debate on the current decisions the governor's making, the only option available to them, again, is that nuclear option to end the whole thing, which, as many people have said, does put into question some of, though not all, but some of those streams of federal assistance and other things. So I think it's just another great example of why some of these checks and balances are really necessary.
You know, I hate to see to get to the point where the legislature then is going to be, and let's just use the pandemic as an example, hiring its own health officer in order to try and present countervailing evidence to what the state has under the executive department. And although that may sound a little crazy, but I guarantee you it's going to happen, because the only way that they could combat, you know, what has been outlined by the gating criteria of the presidential commission, as well as the state health officer, that we have this whole infrastructure under DH, is for this legislative arm to go out and hire their own experts. Now it's going to be a who you believe kind of situation. And there really should be a limit as it relates to the capacity of the legislature to go out there and start spending money and hiring their own experts in order to try and contradict what's being presented by the executive department.
Well, two thoughts to that. I think it's a perfectly fair question. Of course, for the legislature to spend that kind of money or to engage in that would take broad consensus among the body to do so. But second, I think it's worth looking at what other states have done, and we've seen this already. Other states have similar measures in place in Utah, Alaska, Kansas, Georgia, Connecticut. We've seen a number of states where and seen, frankly, different perspectives. Some lawmakers, some legislatures have, for example, in Connecticut, have joined the governor in extending the state of emergency and, in fact, extended it beyond the governor's initial request, as I understand it. Whereas you've seen in Utah and Kansas, the legislature call into question components of those executive orders and have effectively brought together consensus to get to a better answer and a better decision. Look, if the governor and his team are as confident as they have presented, and I believe they certainly believe it, they should have no problem making their case to lawmakers and bringing the data forward. This is about transparency and checks and balances. And I certainly, Newell, you're absolutely right to point out there are some logistical pieces that that have to be worked out and will. We're certainly in the process now of reviewing the bills that have been filed, some of which reflect our recommendations, some of which do other things. And the special session over the course of the next 30 days, I know a lot of this debate is important and good to have so we get to the right answer. The wrong answer, in our opinion, though, is the status quo of a lack of that balance and a lack of any check on that power.
So when we talk about, let's just go to the nomenclature, the next item of safe and unsafe versus essential or non-essential. Isn't that going to require a whole lot of changes and fine-tuning and a lot of laws? Because the fact of the matter is that there's that third branch of government that we need to think about as well, and that's the courts.
Yep.
Part of the challenge as it relates, having worked in disasters and disaster declarations, and I'll go to Katrina, for example, as my personal experience. If you're not nimble, you're not going to be able to face the challenges that are presented day in and day out as it relates to these issues. And that's part of the challenge. And it's always about whether or not government reach, and in some cases overreach, in some people's perspective as it relates to these emergency conditions, that it be equally applied.
Yep.
And part of the challenge that not only this governor but other governors have had across the country, and we've yet to see where the courts are going to end up on these issues, because there's a series of cases across this country moving through the courts at the present time. When you take a sector of the economy and you restrict it as a whole, as opposed to taking pieces and parts and subparts of that economic sector of the economy and outlawing certain individual activities, that has a much more difficult time passing constitutional muster than otherwise.
You're absolutely right. And part of the challenge with all of this, and part of the reason we went down the path of really studying this issue and pulling together data and research, is because the jurisprudence on this is largely a century old. We haven't litigated a lot of these issues in a very long time. At our last count, and this is a few weeks old, so I suspect it's more than this, there have been more than 500 lawsuits filed across the country related to the health emergencies in various states and locales. The courts certainly will uphold some of previous rulings on this, but technology and the world has changed dramatically since the courts have been faced with these kinds of questions. So we expect an entire, a really hard look at the existing jurisprudence, the existing case law on it. And I hard to predict what you'll find in that. You're absolutely right. That's going to take years to work out. But blanket bans are just largely ineffective, and both at controlling the spread of the virus, and certainly in the economic crisis we now face. The other thing that's worth noting about the courts is what we have seen, even in the existing jurisprudence, is that the longer the emergency continues, so the longer these orders go in, the more skeptical the courts have been about upholding them. And so what we expect to happen is, now that we are 6, 7 months, 8 months into this, in some cases, and the knowledge base about the virus and how to contain it and how to treat it has grown exponentially, I think we're going to start to see some of the courts take a less permissive view of these executive orders. And that's what happened certainly 100 years ago, the last time the courts faced this. We expect that to happen again now.
It's going to be interesting to see. I'm not so willing to jump to that conclusion, especially now that we look across the country, and Louisiana being now the outlier in a positive way, where we've seen this reemergence of cases and positivity rates in the vast majority of states in this country at the present time, and a relatively few, Louisiana being one, that's been able to hold its positivity rate lower than others. And in fact, we're no longer on the heat map considered red. So when you consider that, and you're looking at what's gone on in Europe that had, you know, earlier onset than we have, the reemergence of the pandemic there, I'm not so, and look, I've been a strong advocate of being able to save lives and livelihoods and finding that delicate balance. And it is a very delicate balance. And I've been reluctant to criticize elected leaders, because we are in uncharted territory here. And even scientists in the medical professions have been completely confounded by this pandemic. And that's why I'm suspicious of the legislature calling themselves into session in the month of September, and this pandemic and this disease is still revealing itself. And it's not been consistent for a 30-day period yet, medically. And so when I look at all of these studies, and I've read as probably as much as anybody as it relates to this, and I talk to doctors 2, 3, 4 times a week on this show, I've yet to have a physician, a doctor, an expert, an epidemiologist tell me how we get out of this circle. Because in their view, we don't. So when we talk about the governor saying that we might be in phase 3, 75% of capacity until there's a vaccine and or therapeutics that hit the market, that sounds overreaching and it sounds egregious. But when you go to the experts, and I've been to the ones on the Democratic side and the Republican side, and no one has been able to tell me how we get out of this circle, I don't think that's as far reach. And look, I'm all about the economy, and I've been there, but I think this is too soon, quite frankly. And you know, and I really believe that this ends up being more about politics than it ends up being about a whole lot of different things here. Because as you pointed out, the courts haven't come, they hadn't even really tested these cases yet. And we're already going to go out there and make law. And my big concern is going to be, what happens if the courts go the other way? And they say, you acted too early, you were too arbitrary, you were too capricious, you now have infection rates greater than ordinary, and you have some liability because you did things contrary to what prevailing medical science said at this point in time when you made these decisions.
Well, you know, certainly anything's possible. We have already seen courts in far from what we would call conservative, not that this is a partisan issue, but in
Oh, but it is. Let's be honest. Let's be honest. It is a partisan issue.
You know, I don't.
We have to be blind, dumb, and stupid to not say that this isn't a partisan issue. It is. I mean, as a Republican, I can easily say it's a partisan issue. It has been. We've made it one.
That may well be true. I think though we got to take a step back here. You know, obviously, I can't speak to the motivations of lawmakers for calling this session. What we've been talking about some of these solutions for some time now. But I think, you know, Newell, there's certainly a lot of uncertainty, and we're going to continue to learn more. But I too have been a voracious consumer of information and data related to this. What we're also starting to see, and this has not been, the setting aside the structural issues that I would agree with, whether we were in a pandemic or not, but since you brought these up, I think it's worth noting, you know, the numbers we're now seeing, and we're collecting this data now, so I don't have a complete picture, but what we have seen so far in some parishes, non-COVID excess deaths are now exceeding COVID-related excess deaths. We have seen a dramatic increase in overdoses. We have seen an increase in suicide calls. We see an increase in food and shelter insecurity. The implications of this, to think this is just a money issue, but the health issues related to this are just as dire on the other side of the ledger as they are with COVID. I was talking to a cardiologist friend of mine recently who's been trying to continue to see patients as possible through a Zoom, and now even more recently they've been able to see in person. But the amount of deferred medical care we're seeing because people were not willing to go into the doctor, the health implications of this of the lockdown are getting short shrift. And this is part of the reason this debate is so important, because lives and livelihoods are at risk on both sides of this equation. And the only one,
Daniel, let me let's do this. Let's pick this up right there. We got to get to a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. We're back. We're talking to Daniel Erspammer, CEO of the Pelican Institute. Daniel, I don't disagree with the observations that you were making about the peripheral healthcare challenges and some of the other issues that we're having to deal with as a result of not having our lives back to our normal activities and our normal routines. I would offer the following, though, be careful what you ask for, because when you start evaluating data, and this came up early onset when we, you know, weren't quite sure what this pandemic was going to be all about, is that we've had death experiences in flu seasons that have exceeded 60, 70, 80,000 lives in this country. And when we institute some of these provisions that we're doing now, the reverse happenstance could be that we end up declaring emergencies because of some of that data and data evaluation as well. And it's going to be interesting to see where this plays itself out in the courts, because, you know, having sat on a hospital board in excess of 20 years, almost every year we go on diversion because of the flu season, that we don't have the capacity in order to deal with it. So I kind of look with a curious eye when we start talking about how many deaths that we have that are above the normal, you know, experience rate that we would have as opposed to otherwise, because it could create some serious challenges for us from an operational standpoint. Not to mention the fact that one of the challenges here is that this fragmented approach that we've had in this country as it relates to national, state, and local has very much been the reason that we've had difficulties in getting our hands around this, because we have jurisdictions that are actually acting like they're an island in the sea, and their boundaries are not penetrated by citizens who may have a higher positivity rate in a parish that has a coterminous boundary.
There's no question. There's still a lot we don't know, but there's a lot we do know, and there's a lot more we know now than we knew 6 months ago. And I think what has happened is we have looked at this question entirely through the lens of the COVID crisis and not the dual crises we face now, which are both COVID and a variety of health crises. You're right. These are only partial numbers, but they're really telling. And I'll give you one that particularly struck me as we look at overdoses. This is a number that has been public in East Baton Rouge Parish. The total number, the previous year's record for an overdose is 126 overdose deaths in East Baton Rouge Parish. Through mid-September, we've already seen 174. Sure. The mental health crises we're going to see to come out of this are going to be substantial. All we're asking for is that debate happen, that these numbers be released, and that a broad a series of voices are able to weigh on in these issues. And what we know is that workers, people out of work, working families, entrepreneurs, and business leaders across the state are at extreme frustration at arbitrary, what they see as often far too arbitrary rules. People's lives are being hurt in ways we can't even begin to quantify now. And yet those conversations do not happen. Questioning whether the lockdowns that continue or the restrictions that continue are a good thing are met with derision instead of engaging in a debate and presenting counter data and presenting information. I'll give one more
piece. What are y'all going to do about, you know, the fact that mayors and parish presidents can place more restrictive, they just can't place less restrictive? Are y'all going to do away with that too?
Again, I think that's a whole separate conversation about the structure of city and parish government. But absolutely not. This is dealing with the state's response.
My argument about this, the prematurity of this, is why would we not want to ensure, if we're really thinking about business operations, how we weave this into the state operationally, top to bottom, why would we once again try and craft a fragmented solution as it relates to this issue? Because right now you have, the city of New Orleans, who met the gating criteria long before most other parishes that actually had exceeded it, reduced their numbers long before. And Thursday we have a press conference that we're going to go to, I don't know what phase, 2.8, maybe 3.0.
Right.
I don't know what phase it's going to be and what additional restrictions are going to be placed. The fact of the matter, we really haven't solved anything if we allow this continued fragmented approach to, especially as it relates to a pandemic, because it's not like they're an island in the sea.
Yeah.
And it's not like a storm that usually has some geographical effect and boundary to the impact. And it's more like, the situation of terrorism. And that's why I brought up the thing about the national, the federal government, because the federal government is going to be in a much better position to deal with if we have, a kind of terrorist activity that impacts the country as a whole, that we're jumping over all these hurdles and stuff in order to, to create these operational hurdles for a governor. It just doesn't make any sense to me in some respects.
I hear what you're saying. I'll tell you this. There is never a wrong time to put checks and balances in government. This is the entirety of the American experiment and the entirety of what has worked so successfully at protecting individuals in government. And there's never a wrong time to have debate. There's never a wrong time to ask for more data and put more checks on government power. That has proven true and true and true no matter what the situation. So I understand you're calling in the question, and I can't speak to others' motivations.
You're being a little disingenuous. That's the debate. Because you're talking about the debate, and I don't disagree with that. But to change the standard operating procedure and how you're going to weave this into government operationally on a vote immediately after that debate, I agree with you. Let's talk about the debate. But the fact of the matter is what quarter of this pandemic are we in right now? Do you know? First quarter, second quarter, halftime, third, fourth?
I think we're probably somewhere in the middle of the second quarter.
So we're probably somewhere in the middle of the second quarter. And what we're going to do is, so when we look at outcomes, where did we go wrong operationally if we're just looking at the pandemic outcomes? One would have to be crazy to say, well, we've been less than successful in driving the numbers down because the numbers are lower than they've ever been since this started.
You're asking the wrong question, would be my argument to that. The question is, how do we make sure we protect both lives and livelihoods from COVID and every other? How do we create an environment that everyone can thrive and that we reduce risk and harm, right? And so it's without making this about
the governor, it's difficult. But didn't he move to phase three knowing that there were still some areas that were kind of on the brink and were beyond the gating criteria still, and move to phase three anyway? And that was, in fact, the balance of lives versus livelihoods?
I think those people across the state, the tens of thousands who have lost their job and who are suffering significant health challenges, and whose family members have, would tell you that that balance is not there right now. But the fact of the matter is that.
So what would the balance be?
What would it be in
gainfully employed in a positivity rate for maybe five times what it is right now? I don't know. What is it?
Well, let's talk about outcomes for a minute, because if you start to stack up the data, you start to look at various locations, and this is admittedly incomplete data right now, because we won't ever have complete data, but we have a lot more than we had before. And what we know from that is,
and that makes for a good debate. That makes for a good debate to have incomplete data.
Well, there's never going to be complete data in this case.
In fact, the medical experts will tell you that pretty much 2 years post-event, once you're able to scrub all of the data, which is how they deal with the flu. The data with the flu is not completely and totally relevant till typically 2 years post-season. I mean, that's just the realities of the infrastructure of our country right now.
So if I'm understanding you right, would you suggest that we don't make decisions until 2 years after?
No. What I'm telling you is that our country has completely failed ourselves as it relates to this issue, because I believe that's too long of a period of time.
Absolutely.
Because we really haven't put in the reporting mechanisms necessary to really react to this in the fashion that y'all are trying to legislatively approve right now.
I hear what you're saying. And look, we could have a debate, and I'd love to. We started down that road about what the right answer to the balance of protecting health and livelihood and across the board. What we want to make sure, though, is that in our structure of government, whether it's now or next month, or it would have been better to, it's like the old adage about planting a tree, right? It was better to do it a year ago, but today is better than tomorrow. And that we have better checks and balances in our government system, so that decisions about that are so consequential about people's lives don't rest in the hand of one person or one branch of government, but that our government operates effectively at making those decisions and holding each other accountable to the right decisions and the right data. And so that's what we're talking about today. Again, I'd be happy to continue down the path of debate around the lockdowns and everything else. We could go a whole bunch of rounds about that, and we don't both have good points of view.
I don't totally disagree with you. My bigger issue is that why now in September? And it seems to me that we would be better served to work out an operational structure, a decision-making authority structure, infrastructure, the manner in which we address this, by having more complete data. In fact, you know, the side effects of this disease, we haven't even figured out in many cases as to why. And, you know, the bigger challenge is the silence of this disease, of people walking around that are asymptomatic. And so that is kind of the issue for me more than anything else. I love the lofty notions of checks and balances. I get it. I believe in it. I believe in the constitutional republic that we all adore here. And I love the way that it operates. But we got to have it make sense operationally. And without data and without a complete understanding of what remedial measures and remediation that we've taken, and whether or not that was valid, invalid, or otherwise, I still think it's early. And it's easy to Monday morning quarterback in the comfort of an air-conditioned office with 20/20 vision. But when you're down in the trenches making these decisions and having to be nimble and trying to synthesize everything that's coming to you in uncharted territory, going to some other legislative think tank under the auspices of checks and balances. I don't know about that. I certainly don't know about it in September. But
well,
anyway,
I think it's important whenever we do it, and I think the debate is good. I have great admiration for those men and women who've stood up and are in public office, and you're absolutely right. They have a big job. I think that's why we need more voices to the table, more accountability in the system. And as always, I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you, Daniel. Appreciate you. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Coming on as well. But I don't think we're as far apart as we think we are.
I think that's right.
All right.
I agree.
Daniel, thank you so much. All right. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.